There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Castaway, what's your literary sustenance on a desert island?
Today we're welcoming back a guest who's been on for Children's Book of the Week, who we're now thanking by stranding on an island. It seems a bit mean, but that's how we roll on talking of books. So we're currently in the middle of chatting to children's author Julia Johnson. She's lived in the UAE for more than 40 years and has been sharing her experiences of the region via her fiction. The Pearl Diver was her first, and many more books have followed, including award-winning The Turtle Secret and the one that she was telling us about today, her latest book, The Secret of the Cave. She also has a background in performing and teaching and has read stories on radio and TV for audiobooks and theatre, which you can tell as soon as she opens her mouth on the radio. Hello, Julia.
Hello.
You do have a wonderful radio voice.
Oh, thank you.
So we've stranded you on a desert island with three books. Let's start with book one. What's the first book that you're bringing with you?
The first book is The Power of One by Bryce Courtney.
And how did you come across this book?
My daughter recommended it to me, actually, years and years ago. And she's quite good at knowing what I'd like to read. So I read it and I loved it. It's not hugely subtle. The characters are quite black and white. But the story is thoroughly gripping and it's huge. So plenty to sustain me on my desert island, which I thought was important. I did specifically think about being alone, and I think this is a very empowering story about finding the power of one within you. And I think, for me, that is quite a difficult concept. I don't think I'm hugely self-sufficient. I'd like to be more so. And I'd obviously have to find that inner strength if I were on a desert island.
And I think that's something the character of this book really does find during the book. It shows how he evolves and develops and gets this certainty and courage to push forward for what he really believes in.
Well, he really has to, doesn't he? Because it's about a little boy called PK, who I think at the start of the story is only five. His mother's had a nervous breakdown and he's sent off to a boarding school where he's really bullied.
So where and when does the book open?
I think the book opens about 1939 in South Africa, where there's a lot of racial tensions. And he is sort of subjected to the anger that the Boers feel towards the Ruinex, as they call them,
the English,
yes. He's just a symbol for them. And there's one very vindictive character called the Judge, who he manages up to a point in a similar way that Bryce Courtney himself did. I think Bryce Courtney used stories. He was a very good storyteller. And he used stories as a way of protecting himself, a bit like Scheherazade. So, you know, he continued telling stories but never gave them the ending and said, you can't have the next bit if I'm not here.
Yeah.
So that's how he protected himself. And in this, PK actually does the judge's homework, because the judge is brawny but he's not got much brain. So he does the judge's homework and that keeps the judge at bay to a certain extent.
Because, of course, the judge needs to pass the year to get out of the school.
Absolutely.
And both of them want that to happen.
They both certainly do, yes.
So you mentioned him having to protect himself with stories. This is Bryce Courtney actually talking about this.
I remember in the orphanage at about 5 or 6 years old, I had an English name and that was enough. You know, I was an Englishman and therefore I had to be beaten up regularly. I was also the smallest kid in the school. And one of these big, beefy, giant guys that would come up and say, I'm going to beat you up, of Axel Yodon. And I used to say, look, don't hit me. Please don't hit me. If you don't hit me, I'll tell you a story. And they'd all gather around and I'd invent a story. And I'd never actually tell them the end. And I'd say, anybody hits me in the orphanage before tomorrow morning, you don't hear the end of the story. And so I have been, in a sense, telling stories since I was 6 years old.
I just find that wonderful. That's Bryce Courtney talking about how he began quite early in as a storyteller.
But I don't think he actually started writing.
No,
his 50s.
He didn't.
This book was published in 1989, so a good while after. And yet does capture really vividly the experience of his childhood and his teenage years. It takes us up to 17, 18, that sort of age.
Yes.
And shows so much about the influences of other people on his life and how they help mould him.
Oh, there's a wonderful cast of characters, isn't there? I mean, I just love the Doc. He's a fantastic character. And they realise PK's potential. Initially, he thinks that it's better to be inconspicuous, because if you're very clever, you stand out from the crowd and you're asking for trouble. But the Doc teaches him that, you know, he should capitalise on his own intelligence to stand out from the crowd is a good thing. And he learns to do that through boxing. Mm. And I didn't think I'd particularly enjoy a book about boxing. It's not the sort of thing
I was
I'd
a little
about.
Surprised when I saw this was one of your Castaway books, because
yes.
It sounded, because I hadn't read it before it was put down on the list. And yet the boxing, it's classic, it's not actually about boxing. It's
no,
about
life.
No, but
there's a lot of really good descriptions about boxing.
Yeah.
And if you didn't know anything about it before, you certainly do learn things through it. Not that I'm particularly desperate to learn about boxing, but, you know, it was quite an interesting book from that point of view.
I think so, and it shows right the way through the quote that he has. It's first with the head, then with the heart.
Yes.
And that's how you win a boxing match, but
yes.
That's also how you win life.
Absolutely, and you have to measure things and take stock of things and plan and have a strategy, which I think I can learn from that idea.
That was a lovely quote, Flora. Do you have anything longer that you'd like to read out for us, Julia, so we can get a feel of the language?
Yes, well, I could read a little bit about The Power of One itself. So Doc is this wonderful character who really taught him about the plants in Africa. They used to go out walking, and he taught him from experience rather than from books, although they did use books as well for identification purposes. Doc had taught me the value of being the odd man out. The man assumes the role of the loner, the thinker, and the searching spirit who calls the privileged and the powerful to task. The power of one was the courage to remain separate, to think through to the truth, and not to be beguiled by convention or the plausible arguments of those who expect to maintain power, whatever the cost. At 14, I had no hope of seeing things quite as clearly as this, but I instinctively understood that power is beguiling, and man does not lightly give it up. To maintain it, he will bend the truth and warp his values. I was a child of Africa. A white child, to be sure, but nevertheless Africa's child. Black breasts which had suckled me and the dark hands which had bathed and rocked me left me with a burden of obligation to resist the white power which would be the ultimate gift from those who now trained me.
Oh. That was Julia Johnson reading from The Power of One by Bryce Courtenay, which is her first book on the Castaway Island. That was a wonderful passage to read out. Thank you. What I find interesting about Bryce Courtenay when I was reading about, because you said that he didn't start writing until he was about
55
or something. Mm. But he clearly had a love of storytelling very early on, before he was even a teenager. And apparently he had a haemophiliac son who died when he was about 27.
Yes.
So until that point, he basically couldn't commit to writing because he needed to make sure that he had a job where he could provide constant care for his son. And I had absolutely no idea. And he's a national treasure in Australia as well.
Yes.
He passed away recently, I think.
Yes, about
5-6 years ago,
yes,
I think.
Yes, sadly. But yes, I think that he felt that writing was too dicey and you can't be assured of an income. Obviously, he was a bestseller, but he didn't know that that he was going to be. So I think he was in advertising before and very good at it.
Well, I think what you gather from the book throughout is whatever he set his mind to do, he achieved, and he achieved to, you know, extremely well.
Yes.
But I think that what the quote you read out is, it's a beautiful part of a lot of what comes through the book is this, his internal understanding of the racial tensions that you mentioned earlier that were happening in South Africa at the time, and his sort of his horror at it, but told very straight, because when he's a young boy seeing all this coming through, he just writes it, so the judgment isn't there, but you can understand exactly what's happening.
Yes, he writes it, because I don't think he necessarily understands it, but he writes it, so yes, it's very simply told, I think,
but very, very powerful and very eye-opening, I think.
Yes,
is a really
very And I think part of what I like about the book is that it's fast moving, it's exciting, it's powerful, it's amusing quite often.
Some very funny pieces.
Very funny pieces, yes. And the characters are very well drawn. And it's poignant as well. I mean, you know, you laugh, you cry, everything.
Yeah.
So plenty of content there for a desert island. Keep me going. I think you can read it over and over again because there's more in it each time.
I thought what you said about the fact that you got the impression that he'd do whatever he set his mind to. And there's a wonderful story about the writing of his first book. So apparently he was reading a book that he wasn't particularly impressed with, and he said, oh, I could do better than this, and threw it across the room. And then he said, I'll have finished my book within a year. And so he set himself the deadline of 1 year to finish the book, and it got to midnight on the day and he hadn't finished his book, and he'd never cried, or he hardly ever cried, and his wife came in and apparently he was just tears running down his face, that he was like, I've not finished. He said, you had that epiphany at 3 o'clock in the morning, you still have 3 hours to get it done,
and
go and do it. And he did it.
He
met his first deadline.
I think that's amazing, to be so disciplined. I mean, he really must have the power of one to do that. I'm not disciplined like that. But he used to get up every day at 4:30 to start the day and do all his chores and things first, and then write and write and write for 12 hours, I think.
Yeah.
And you see in the book that started, he was in the boxing gym at 5:30 from the age of 7.
Yes.
And
dedication.
He wanted to do it himself. He had that dedication.
And determination, yeah.
Castaway. What's your literary sustenance on a desert island?
Remind us what you brought along for book one.
Book one was The Power of One by Bryce Courtney.
And what are we moving on to?
The Wind in the Willows by Kenneth Graham.
And when do you remember reading The Wind in the Willows when you were a
very
child?
Little.
When
yes.
you were very little?
My mum shared it with me. My mum was a great storyteller, and she introduced me, I think, to most of the classics. My father as well. But she particularly was a really good storyteller, and she liked sharing books with us. And I think a lot of my story writing comes from her. She loved animals particularly.
When you said that you were coming on the show and that you were choosing your books, I expected there to be a children's book among them, seeing as you are a...
So I haven't disappointed you.
No, not at all. You wouldn't. But the fact that you are a children's writer, often children's writers choose a children's book among their three books that they're bringing to the island. But I was wondering which one you were going to choose, because there's probably quite a few that you've read and quite a few that are very dear to you. What makes The Wind in the Willows so special?
Yes, that's a good question. I mean, I've enjoyed lots and lots of books, as you suggest, as a child. But this one reminds me of my childhood, and I love the animal characters, the sort of humanised animal characters. I like the lyricism of the writing in parts. In parts it's quite fast moving, in parts it's very funny, especially when we come to Mr. Toad. But in parts it's really lyrical, and it's particularly descriptive of the English countryside and all the changing seasons. And I live near a stream. It's not a river, I don't have a river bank, but I do have a bank of a stream running through my garden because I live in an old watermill. And so I think it would transport me very nicely to my home, and I could think about home and remember it through the story. And we actually have had an otter in our stream, so
I love in Wind of the Willows that is one of the things that's so appealing is you have the five really main characters, Mole and Rat and Badger and Toad and Otter, and each of them almost exemplifies a different aspect of human character.
Definitely. And when you read the story, I think you can point a finger at a lot of people that you know who are just like that. But they've all got something nice about them.
Oh, absolutely.
Apart from the weasels and stoats, they're not very nice.
Though, interestingly, I was rereading it. I haven't read it for a long time. My dad read Wind in the Willows to us when I was a child, so it takes me straight back to that, which is lovely. And early on, Rat does say, when he's talking about all the different animals in the wood, he says, oh, the stoats and the weasels, some of them are my very good friends. You can't quite trust them. But, so you suddenly realise that, you know, there's two sides to every story, perhaps.
Yes, I agree. I think the characters are nicely drawn. And there's, I mean, even Toad, who's full of conceit and hilarity as a result, he's good-hearted too.
He's very generous. He always wants his friends to be joining in the adventures and loving it as much as he is. He just doesn't see.
But he wants praise all the time, and he's very puffed up. Yes, he's blind to his Although he does recognise his faults to a certain extent, but the next minute he's puffed up again, isn't he, and bragging. And
yet probably he's the most memorable of the characters from the book, I wonder.
Do you think that's because of shows and films and, you know, adaptations as a result of the book, rather than...
Yes,
in
it could be, because the second book was Toad of Toad Hall,
yes.
which became a play and
yes.
and so on, didn't it?
And it's also been sort of revamped by Tom Morehouse now, who's focusing on a new generation of Mr. Toad's relatives as well.
And I think that's wonderful that the meat of these stories has so much to it that
yes.
it can be brought out again for a new generation in a different way.
They've rewritten it, haven't they?
He's
updated the language.
I think Tom has set them a 100 years in the future from when they started, so present day.
1950s.
The idea being, I think, that Mr. Toad was...
He was frozen in the ice house.
In the ice house.
Oh.
And when he came to, it's their great-grandchildren of the original characters who come and help him.
Okay.
Which brings a lovely different aspect to it, because Mr. Toad has got to get to know today's world. And what would Mr. Toad do with the internet and social media? I mean, you can just imagine.
I can imagine that being very funny.
Yeah. Imagine Mr. Toad on Twitter.
But, yes. But I think the charm of it for me is the slightly old-fashioned writing, beautiful descriptions, and I like the words that are chosen. So I wouldn't want to feel that was sort of overridden by...
I don't think it would be. I mean, I think what's lovely is you have the two of them working side by side, and I don't think we're ever going to lose the Wind in the Willows original.
Speaking of beautiful language, is there a passage that you wouldn't mind reading out for us?
Yes, well, as we haven't had a particularly humorous passage so far, shall I go for something a little bit funnier this
yes.
time? So, obviously, that's going to be about Toad. And he goes through various love-hate relationships with things. So he's been through boats, and he's recently had a horse-drawn caravan. But suddenly, an enormous car overtakes the caravan, and the horse... rears, and the caravan goes over into the ditch. The rat danced up and down in the road, simply transported with passion. "You villains!" he shouted, shaking both fists. "You scoundrels! You highwaymen! You road hogs! I'll have the law on you! I'll report you! I'll take you through all the courts!" His homesickness had quite slipped away from him, and for the moment he was the skipper of the canary-coloured vessel driven on a shoal by the reckless jockeying of rival mariners, and he was trying to recollect all the fine and biting things he used to say to masters of steam launches when their wash, as they drove too near the bank, used to flood his parlour carpet at home. Toad sat straight down in the middle of the dusty road, his legs stretched out before him, and stared fixedly in the direction of the disappearing motor car. He breathed short. His face wore a placid, satisfied expression, and at intervals he faintly murmured, "Poop, poop."
Brilliant. So that was Julia Johnson reading from The Wind in the Willows by Kenneth Graham, which was her second Castaway choice on the island.
Castaway. What's your literary sustenance on a desert island?
So this week we've stranded children's author Julia Johnson, who's lived in the UAE for about 40 years, or more than 40 years, and she's been sharing her experiences of the region via her fiction, The Pearl Diver being her first children's book, and she's had many more since then, including the award-winning The Turtle Secret, and the latest one she was telling us about earlier today, The Secret of the Cave. Remind us of your first two Castaway choices, Julia, for anybody who's just tuning in now.
The first one was The Power of One by Bryce Courtney. And the second was the children's classic, The Wind in the Willows, by Kenneth Graham.
We're moving on to some non-fiction now, aren't we?
Yes.
What's your third book?
It's Voices in the Ocean by Susan Casey.
And why have you chosen this, and where did you come across it first?
Well, I've chosen it because I think if I'm stranded on a desert island, that my only friends are likely to be dolphins, if I can make friends with them, which I would love to do. It would be fantastic. I know that sounds a little bit far-fetched, but I don't mean personally sort of touching, but just relating, integrating with them, which Susan Casey does in her book. I came across the book when she came to the Literature Festival about 3 or 4 years ago. She didn't have a huge crowd, which was rather disappointing. She was in quite a small room, and I think probably 30 people. It affected me enormously. I thought she was extremely articulate, most interesting. Some of what she told us was absolutely fascinating. Some of it was horrifically eye-opening. It's not all a bed of roses, this book, because she takes numerous studies and explores them, and she explores things from her own personal angle as well. She's done a lot of research, flown personally to various places where dolphins are caught, and we'll go into that perhaps a little bit more later. It left a lasting impression on me, and the book is very well written, and it's a very easy style. I think she was a reporter, and she reports very well and very easily. So, yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I've had experiences with dolphins myself. So it reflected that.
So Voices in the Ocean is about dolphins. But what's kind of the focus of this book that she's writing? What is she trying to achieve with it?
I think she's trying to show us that we are not the only people, the only creatures on the planet. That we do rather serve ourselves. And dolphins particularly can be huge money makers. If you look around the world at various dolphinariums, people flock to them. They love that interaction with dolphins. But do the dolphins actually appreciate it? And I think part of the problem is that bottlenose dolphins, for instance, look like they're smiling. But that doesn't mean they're feeling happy. And wild animals should be left in the wild. So I think she's drawing our attention to the various ways we exploit wildlife, particularly in this case, dolphins and toothed whales, because the orcas come into it as well.
So the book is essentially about people's relationships with dolphins, good and bad.
Yes.
And how we've interacted with them over the years.
Yes.
And the results of that.
The studies that have been done done over the years, the experiments that have been performed on them, the way they've helped the Navy, for instance, and helped people a lot. I mean, there's some amazing and quite disturbing incidents in the book. And she herself started her research as a result of an encounter with a pod of spinner dolphins, and it inspired her to do the research. She's always been interested in the sea, but that's what first inspired her, I think.
I read that it was a sort of two-year global adventure that
yes.
she took to discover everything that she's put in the book about dolphins.
Yes, I think it was. She went all over the place. She went to Japan. She went to the Solomon Islands. Both those places capture dolphins, and it's quite horrific how they go about it. They've got a natural cove where they herd the dolphin in, and then they put a barricade across so they can't get out again. And they choose the dolphins that they think are going to be easiest to teach, usually the calves, separate them from their mothers, and slaughter the rest. And then sell them for huge amounts of money.
It's horrific.
So they can perform, you know, for people. And I think that the part of the problem is, I think people are unintentionally sometimes contributory to this because they don't know. They think lovely dolphins leaping through hoops, clapping their fins and so on. You know, they think that they're happy.
They don't see the journey beforehand.
No, they don't. They don't know where they've come from. They don't ask the question. So,
and it's not just true of dolphins either, though.
No.
It's a big discussion at the moment with all animals.
Absolutely, yes, I quite agree. But she's specifically focused on them here.
I feel this ties in also to the interest that you have in environmental protection and, you know, looking after the world that we have that comes through the books you write yourself.
Yes, very much so. And I love swimming. It's one of my passions, swimming. And so, you know, I've written about turtles, and I'd like to write a story actually about dolphins. And I've had experiences myself. I've swum with a dolphin in Egypt with my son. It was a wild dolphin. It had been rescued from a net. And when a boy whistled, it came into the bay and swam. And I've swum with wild pods in New Zealand, where you just got into the water if they were around and you swam. And if you were lucky, they mingled with you. If they didn't feel like it, they swam off. So it was very much up to them. Mm. But I think, you know, when people realise just how capable dolphins are, perhaps they would treat them with more respect.
You mentioned that they helped the Navy. Do you remember how they did that?
Well, I think, you know, they've got this sonar
yep.
that, that they use. So they could actually find mines and things like that during the war, and they were taught to do that, probably at their own risk. You know, the Navy was risking their lives. And we interfere with their lives in so many ways. I mean, not just with the terrible pollution in the sea, but things like explosions underwater when people are testing things. Explosions can kill dolphins because of their... The sound waves can actually kill them.
Oh my goodness.
So I learned a lot from the book myself.
You mentioned, so it was a two-year journey that she went on researching this book, and she obviously met a lot of interesting people doing research along the way. Who stood out for you of the people that she interviewed and interacted with?
I don't think anybody particularly. There were some strange encounters. There was a woman called Joan Ocean. I think she must have called herself that, but who had a sort of dolphin community, and they used to go out and swim with dolphins every morning for hours. It was a very benign community. I mean, there was, you know, it was almost like a worship in a way, a sort of strange cult. And there were other things that were a little odd, I have to say, but there you go. It takes all sorts.
Is there anything that you'd like to specifically read out so that we can hear how Susan writes in the book?
Yes, her first encounter's lovely. Where she goes out in the bay, she's feeling low. She's divorced. Her father has died very unexpectedly, very suddenly. He was her rock. And she goes out and she has this amazing encounter. But I think this bit is probably the thing that I thought was amazing. Right. In the book Beautiful Minds, biologist Maddalena Beazzi recalls tailing a pod of bottlenoses on one grim foggy morning along the coast of Los Angeles. The animals were hunting, ignoring her research boat, as they searched for fish. Finally, they found a huge school of sardines and began herding them. If there's anything that commands a dolphin's attention, it is a motherload of fish. So Beazzi was surprised when one of the dolphins suddenly broke away from feeding and headed out to sea, swimming at top speed. The rest of the pod followed. So did Beazzi and her crew. The dolphins arrowed about 3 miles offshore and then they stopped, arranging themselves in a circle. In the centre, the scientists were shocked to see a girl's body floating. She was a teenager and barely alive, her suicide attempt only moments away from succeeding. Around her neck, the girl had strung a plastic bag containing her identification and a farewell letter. Thanks to the dolphins, she was rescued. I still think and dream about that cold day, Beazzi wrote, and that tiny pale girl, lost in the ocean and found again for some inexplicable reason by us, by the dolphins.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Wonderful, wonderful creatures, aren't they?
Yes, and I know personal stories, not quite as shivery as that one, but, you know, where dolphins have surrounded somebody who was attacked by a shark and actually guided them back to the boat.
There's a little Guardian review of Voices in the Ocean where they mention things like, I think, was it the Flipper was kind of the start of dolphin mania in about the 60s. And Dick Van Dyke was, apparently he was saying that he was out on a surfboard in the middle of the ocean, just lying there, and he felt himself being nudged towards the shore. Because the instinctive reaction of a dolphin is that when they see a stray human, they think, oh, it's, you know, the pod is missing this stray human. It needs to be returned to its pod of humans.
Yes, yes.
Which I think is quite sweet.
Yes. And there's a dolphin mentioned in this book called Fungi, who lives in Dingle in Ireland. And he's been separated from his pod. Don't know how, but there are lone dolphins around occasionally. And he comes into the bay. Now, this is very benign, though. The people of Dingle do actually capitalise on it, but they never keep him there. He can go if he wants to. You can go on a boat. You're 90% certain of seeing him, but not 100%. So, you know, that's a sort of good relationship with a dolphin. But unfortunately, there are a lot of bad ones.
I lived in the Turks and Caicos Islands for about 3 years, and there's a dolphin there with a similar relationship to the island called Jojo, and he's a hugely popular character on the island. And if you go out and see him by chance, you see him, and if you don't, you don't. But he's a major attraction of the island, but they don't keep him in captivity. He just turns up occasionally, and that's the way it is.
And I think too, you know, we don't, oh, so many of them are, you know, they look alike, don't they, to us, certainly. So we don't know how often they replace them in these dolphinariums. And intermingling with them, we often give them diseases because we're touching them. And, you know, you shouldn't really touch wild creatures unless you have to.
So that was Voices in the Ocean, which was your third book by Susan Casey, your non-fiction choice. Just recap all the books, the other books that you've brought along with you today, and your criteria for choosing them as well.
The Power of One by Bryce Courtney. And I would like to find my own empowering strength within me to survive my desert island. The Wind in the Willows by Kenneth Graham to take me back to my childhood and remind me of my home in England. And Voices in the Ocean by Susan Casey, because I would love to be able to make friends without touching with dolphins in the ocean. Brilliant. On my island.
Thank you so much for joining us on the Castaway Island, Julia. You are released.
Thank you so much.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.